live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to explore in-depth the corporate state of surveillance, Counterpunch, Ralph Nader. We're also going to look at new information that the American media has either ignored or is unaware of that shows that the CDC has had it wrong and has known that it's had it wrong about no link between autism and vaccines. Oh yes, there is a link. They should have known it. But unfortunately, the FDA and the CDC has chosen instead to protect the person who lied about these studies. This is a felon who's on the run, and we're going to look at the actual Danish study showing you the truth of that. Also today from our public health segment, what the cancer industry doesn't want you to know about chemotherapy and radiation. Also from our commentary section today, we're going to look at man-made mess on the environment, tapped out and going dry. Can we live with water's new normal? From Trends Journal. Interesting commentary. We have a lot to share. And of course, we always start with the latest on health and healing. And you can watch today's show by going to Ustream channel, then searching for Gary Null. You can listen anywhere over the telephone if for any reason you can't get to a land-based station channel, or over the internet. And by the way, everywhere people are listening over the telephone. Last month, the numbers were just off the chart. We're number one in the entire Western Hemisphere, all the thousands and thousands of stations, this program, listening by telephone. That number to listen to is 619-550-0869. Let's begin. Positive lifestyle changes associated with longer telomeres. Now, I've been saying this for a long time, because this is what my own original clinical and basic research found when I was doing anti-aging research in the laboratory at the Institute of Applied Biology for 30 years, that by changing several factors, you could increase the telomeres, increase the lifespan of the animal. And it started with the idea that look at how short the average overweight person's life is. Then look at how societies that stay leaner, not skinny, but lean, and have adequate nutrition, not those suffering from starvation, I'm just talking about lean, how much longer they live. And then I just thought, well, would that also be true for animals? Because we know that when a dog or a cat gets fat by eating frequently off the table or boxed dried kibble foods or the non-human grade dog or cat food, that they live short lives. I discovered that when I was noticing, first it was in the United States, I thought it was an anomaly. Then I verified it when I was in France, in Spain, in England, in the Irish countryside, where I was visiting to study longevity and what caused it. And I noticed that on farms, not in the city, but in the farms, the cats and dogs lived longer lives. They were leaner, and they generally ate raw food. Rarely did I see canned or box foods. And if they ate eggs, it was fresh organic eggs. And if it was meat, it was untreated grass-fed, grass-fed beef or lamb or veal, whatever they were feeding. And they also were given fish, lots of fish. But it was not farm-raised fish. It was regular fish, same as the family would eat. So anyway, I then started to realize where I grew up in West Virginia, there was a farm, and they fed that way to the animals, and their dogs and cats lived into their 20s. And two cats, I remember, two Siamese cats lived to 32 and 33, which was considered remarkable. By today's standard, a cat is lucky to get 15, a dog is lucky to get 12. Well, all right, would it work on humans? And so I started with animals, and I simply took away all of the processed food. No standard rat chow. And that caused them to live when I gave them healthy foods. and foods you would not normally consider part of a lab rat's diet. And I would give them beans and rice. I would make up sprout salads and give them juices. And then I gave them a completely open environment, 3,000 square feet. They could run around any place they wanted. And then I put in soothing music. But each thing I gave them increased their longevity. Until where I finally was able to make a presentation to the scientific board. And they were rather incredulous at the outcome. Most didn't believe it. So I had to do it all over again, which took another 2 years. Because they said, well, we don't believe it. And I said, well, look at yourself. I said, everyone in this room is fat. You're all smoking. You drink. You're stressed. And you're out of shape. And they argued that there was no scientific studies proving that anything they were doing was adverse to their health. That's when I also learned an important lesson about the truth is really irrelevant in the choices a person makes. They make choices based upon their ego needs, their career needs, their emoting needs, and the epigenetic conditioning. If you're a group of 100,000 physicians and you believe that chemotherapy works, then it's irrelevant whether it does or does not. Your belief is what's going to dictate you're using it, not the science or the efficacy or safety. And that's true of everything. If a politician that you like tells you, for example, that he believes that we shouldn't be engaged in warlike activities, and you say, I agree with that, I'll support you. And then you support that candidate, and then that candidate ends up being the most warlike, mongering president in American history, in all of American history. Then do you believe what he said, or do you believe what he did? And people frequently cannot reconcile the two, so they simply go into a state of denialism and look for something in what he has done that justifies continuing acceptance. It's like abusive relationships. You have no idea how many times people have come to me where they came with some physical condition, but it was clearly based also on a lot of emotional issues in their home, in abusive relationships, not only verbally or emotionally abusive, but physically abusive. And you ask, why would you tolerate this? First time someone ever lays a hand on you that's inappropriate, that's the last day you should ever see that person the rest of your life. I don't believe in this forgiving nonsense when someone's been abusive to you. They're not going to change. They're only sorry that they now have to apologize. It's like catching a thief. They're not sorry they stole from you. They're only sorry they got caught. And I've just counseled too many people, including heading a whole 5,000 sessions in drug abuse. I saw every lie and con in the world. You know, I'm not going to do it again, and then they do it later that night. So we have to separate out what ideal we want for ourselves and expect from people from the reality of what they're actually doing. And this is not just some of our religious leaders. Look at the Catholic Church. Look at how many times people would never allow you to say a thing that would challenge any aspect of their religion. And yet, massive sexual abuse occurred. It was systemic. It was not occasional. It was constant everywhere in all the different places that the church resided. And it was covered up clear up to the Pope. But try to explain that. Try to have that conversation with anyone, including frequently the victims. It was only after it could no longer be contained. After. But who lost their job because of it? Which high-ranking cardinal, which high-ranking bishop, which high-ranking person or pope was held accountable? Then you start seeing the power of a belief system and the adherence to that belief system. Same way in politics. Same way in almost all of our institutional beliefs. So when I started looking at these scientists that morning around the table after I'd done such work for 2 years and proved that one group of rats that were kept downstairs, that were fed the standard rat chow diet, kept in a little tiny container with artificial light and no human contact, that these lived the normal lifespan. But the ones upstairs who were fed organic, wholesome food, listened to music, had a wonderful, challenging environment, were given a lot of personal bonding and attention, giving supplements, they live 33% longer. That's an enormous difference Could you imagine that would be a person supposed to live to be 100 living to 133? Well, we've never had anyone that lived 133. So it should have been something that was promoted. It should have been in a major magazine, health, scientific magazine. They wouldn't, and I couldn't publish on my own. That was the rules of the Institute. So 133 experiments I did that made a difference were never allowed to be published because it didn't match the belief systems of the people who had a hierarchical position. So much for objectivity in science, so much for open-mindedness and highly scientifically qualified minds. So that's just a little backdrop to the idea that if you think the best and brightest are in education, in medicine, in public health, you're wrong. You don't have to have any college education to have common sense. You don't have to have any scientific background to have a sense of reason. And yet these are the only arbiters of our truth today. More often than not, they've been compromised, either by their own arrogance, ego, narcissism, greed, special interest, or ideology. And hence people who have an abundance of common sense and reason are told, your thoughts don't count. You're not on the Cato Institute. And by the way, when are we going to get over this idea that because you have someone on that represents the special interest groups, that somehow you're showing objectivity when you have them on to show how the American public has been manipulated? To me, no, I would not have on someone who has been a serial abuser with globalization as their weapon against those who've been abused. That to me doesn't show objectivity, that shows fear in the journalists who allow it and encourage it. I could go to an extreme example, but I won't. I think you get the message. In any case, we finally, after all these decades of living in complete and total denial for a lot of reasons about the role of our diet, including massive denial on the snarly, conceited corporate left and those who are just too stupid to understand truth, and boy, there are a bunch of them, they would mock you if you showed any interest in health, as if the only reality were your politically left reality. If you had any other views at all, you were irrelevant to any discussion. I've been there. I've seen that kind of hatred, that bias. It's palpable, including at one of our sister stations. Two of our all of our sister stations. Not Progressive Radio Network, but the other ones, you bet, I've seen it. As if they were right, and if you were reading healthy, you were stupid. You're one of those health nuts. Really? Okay, we'll have that discussion in depth someday. So here we have it. The people who mock truth ultimately become a victim of their mockery. How do they justify their heart attack from eating their diet and their lung cancer from their cigarette smoking and their liver disease from their drinking alcohol and their stress causing their memory loss? If they had listened. But a belief system is the ultimate enemy. More than cancer, heart disease, dementia, it's our belief system that kills us. It enables us, then it kills us. And that's why it's so difficult for people to change. It's not about changing diets. It's not about changing from hamburgers to veggie burgers. It's not changing from iceberg lettuce and a genetically engineered tomato to something that actually tastes good and is good for you. That's easy. Now get the mindset that makes you feel that you're going to be the odd person out, the black sheep, by making those changes. How are others going to look at you? How are you going to feel? Then you start to realize the power of a belief system in mocking and ridiculing, even when the person is doing it right. When Linus Pauling was marching around the White House protesting, which, by the way, he won a Nobel Prize for, and is the only American to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes. But the man who won it in chemistry was mocked as a quack by the quackbusters, the very people that Jane Brody and others could never stop a love of printing their nonsense in the New York Times. And where were the other Nobel Prize winners? Where were the other people who had the courage to do what he did, stand up and do something that was relevant on behalf of a truth? He was considered the odd person out, and when you're the odd person out in America, we have think tanks that work hand in glove with MSNBC and other groups to smear you and destroy you in Fox News. That's all the value they have. They're certainly not the best and brightest people who host those shows. They think they are. They're not. And the people who do have it, who do have their life together, who do have courage, they're never invited to give us their counsel because they're on the outside. So now I get back to this whole idea of telomeres. If we would have learned these lessons from our grandmothers, grandfathers, long ago, if we would have learned the basic common sense from the wise women through centuries, we would have longer telomeres. If we would have listened to the little old ladies in tennis shoes as they were mocked and ridiculed for wanting their fiber and not to have the high heels causing fallen arches and deformed feet, we would have had longer telomeres. For all the people who are talking about food combining and fasting periodically and liver cleanses, we'd have had longer telomeres. Every single major movement was right, and every one of them was marginalized. So now, finally, mainstream medicine says this in The Lancet, the peer-reviewed journal Oncology, quote, improvements in the diet, exercise, stress management, and social support are associated with longer telomeres, meaning DNA protein complex at the end of chromosomes, which shorten with cellular aging. Quote, the current study included men with low-risk prostate cancer who had elected to undergo active surveillance. The men participated in a lifestyle intervention, and an equal group served as controls. Blood samples collected from the subjects at the beginning of the study and after 5 years were analyzed for peripheral blood mononuclear cell telomere length and telomerase level. Men who engaged in lifestyle programs, healthy lifestyle programs, had a longer than average at the end of the study telomeres, while the control group did not. So there they have it. So what you've been listening to on different health programs over the decades was right. Make a healthy choice, and your telomeres, which dictate your biological clock, how long you're going to live, will lengthen, and that will lengthen your quality of life. Make inappropriate choices, and you'll shorten them, and you'll have a shorter life. Finally, mainstream medicine has acknowledged the truth. Isn't it amazing, though? As of today, someone will look at this, some doctors, some nurses, some public health officials, and they say, well, that's kind of interesting. Won't do a thing about it because it will still compete with their condition response unless they're themselves active in lifestyle changes. But it's just nice to know that for those of you who've been exercising, de-stressing, juicing, cleansing, balancing your food intake, keeping your body lean and strong, you've been right all along. The trouble is, with our warped, perverted, fraudulent notion of science today, we are told reality only commences at the moment that science validates it. What about our own personal validation? What about the mother who sees after vaccinations her child regresses? That's not valid. Not if the CDC disputes it. What about all the minors who for decades suffer from black lung and brown lung, and they saw it? That's not valid unless EPA validates it and the CDC validates it. What about all the asbestos? What about the fiberglass? What about all the things we've been exposed to in DDT? And we see what it does. It does. It's not valid until someone in a government position validates it. Okay, that's the way you play your game. I won't play it. I'll live by my own reality, and that's how I live. Because quite frankly, I don't fit in anywhere. Because I just don't think in the way that the average mind is supposed to, conditioned to think, and thank goodness there are a lot of other people who have the same idea. Look for reality without scientific validation or verification. Now, we also know that another thing that causes us to age prematurely and get diseased is inflammation. We talk about it all the time. How certain juices like lemon and grapefruit and watermelon and cabbage, celery and apple are extremely alkalizing to the body and therefore help turn off inflammation. If persons have an inflammatory attack anywhere in the body, whether it's in the muscles like fibromyalgia or in the joints like arthritis, throwing some cayenne pepper or taking a cayenne pepper tablet and throwing in some cat's claw and taking some celery, burdock root, you can help turn off that pain almost instantly. Here's the latest, finally verifying this, the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Dr. Ekbarbili, and also done at France's Institute National Science, says, quote, chronic inflammation impacts healthy aging. Colleagues report that high levels of interleukin 6, which are elevated during chronic inflammation, are associated with a reduction in successful aging, which they define as the absence of chronic disease and disability coupled with optimal physical, cognitive, and cardiovascular respiratory functioning. They looked at 3,044 middle-aged participants in the Whitehall study and 10,000 British civil servants over a five-year period. And what they found was, when you have an increase in interleukin 6, which is a pro-inflammatory marker, then you're going to end up having 47% more likely to have a cardiovascular event, heart attack, stroke, 64% or and more than double the risk of non-cardiovascular death in comparison to subjects with lower levels. So here we have a major study published in one of the most respected medical journals in the world telling us what you have already known. If you keep your diet and lifestyle healthy and clean and anti-inflammatory, like vitamin C and quercetin, vitamin E and coenzyme Q10, all these are anti-inflammatory, then you will live a longer life and have less likelihood of heart disease. Also, B supplements, B vitamin complex, according to the peer-reviewed journal Neurology, can lower the risk of stroke. There were 54,913 subjects in this analysis. What they found was vitamin B6 and B12 could make an enormous difference in lowering your risk of a stroke. I wouldn't have selected that, because I know what will lower your stroke even greater. An onion. An onion a day keeps the strokes away. Also garlic. Garlic keeps a stroke away. Vitamin E thins the blood. Vitamin C thins the blood. Coenzyme Q10 thins the blood. All green juices thin the blood. Kale, watercress, arugula thin the blood. That keeps a stroke away, even more than the B complex. And they're also finally saying in the peer-reviewed journal Nature, based upon a major study here, that people frequently gain weight because they have negative bacteria in the gut. Well, that's simple. The negative bacteria are produced by your lifestyle. So when you're drinking alcohol, and when you're eating sugars, and when you're eating refined carbohydrates or toxic proteins, meat-based proteins, you're going to have bad bacteria. When you eat clean food and have probiotics, you're going to have good bacteria. So the more good bacteria you have, the better your gut is, and hence less weight. That's the latest on health and nutrition. On my Sunday evening talkback show, by the way, I'm going to do an in-depth discussion on the prostate and all the different things men can do to help protect their prostate. Also, I'm going to talk in depth about sexual dysfunction is not a disease, and therefore you shouldn't look at it as one, and all the ways to enhance male and female sexuality. That's coming up. But now we go to our environmental segment of our program. I'm going to share the and public health issues as well. And I'm going to give you some of the latest insights from this area. Now to our public health segment, because as many of you know, we defended Andrew Wakefield, MD, leading gastroenterologist and academic, published multiple papers, textbook, and yet he was singled out to be pillared and destroyed because he was suggesting that looking at children who had been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, there could have been an association with the MMR vaccines, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. He was only one of numerous doctors who were part of the study. So they published the results, and then it was attacked. And the person leading the attack was a Brian Deere. And so I brought Brian Deere on this program to debate, and we debated for an hour. And I first did all my homework on Andrew Wakefield, and I was convinced he was completely innocent. And at the heart of all this was the CDC's saying that vaccines are not linked to autism. And anyone suggesting so is obviously a quack. So here is the latest, which completely exonerates Andrew Wakefield. And this is very specific. Quote, Health Impact News editor's comments. If there is one issue regarding vaccines that the mainstream media joins together with one common voice, it is the claim that autism is linked to vaccines, particularly mercury-containing vaccines. And the mainstream media accepts as fact without ever bothering to investigate that this claim has been proven false and that the man who supposedly invented this claim has now been condemned. That man, who is now the scapegoat of the mainstream media around the world when the topic of autism vaccines is discussed, is Dr. Andrew Wakefield. What the media never reports, however, is that Dr. Andrew Wakefield's study linking the MMR vaccine to autism was one of many studies showing the same link. The mainstream media also ignores the large amount of awards for damages being made to vaccine-damaged children with autism in the U.S. vaccine court, or that other courts of law in other countries are ruling that vaccines cause autism and awarding damages to children with autism. For example, the Italian court rules, quote, vaccine MMR caused autism. There is one man that particularly gets a free pass from exposure to mainstream media, however. This man is currently a fugitive from justice and is somehow escaping capture better than the world's worst terrorist. That man is Dr. Paul Thorsen. Thorsen has been accused of stealing millions of dollars of CDC research money and fabricating studies that supposedly showed there was no link between mercury and vaccines and autism. And yet, the CDC still relies on this man's research to make the claim that there is no link between vaccines and autism. If his research is a fraud, and yet is used as evidence to claim that mercury in vaccine causes no harm when in fact it does, then he is one of the most dangerous men of this generation. But he gets a free pass in the media. Now perhaps, unwittingly, a new study just published and funded by the CDC looks at the same data as the original Thorsen study, which claimed no link between mercury and vaccines and autism. And the results show just the opposite. Now I'm going to quote directly from the new study, which was a Danish study on mercury. And here's what it found. It's rather scientific, but I'll give you the highlights. They looked at this study. They looked at the Danish children, and it actually showed an increase after mercury was removed from the Danish-produced studies in 1992. A study released, however, just 2 weeks ago, shows the exact opposite. That was Thorensen's study. So he could say, look, we got rid of all the mercury in vaccines, and autism continued to go up. So it couldn't have been the mercury. Well, now a new study shows just the opposite, that the rate of autism in Danish children decreased, went down, after mercury was removed. And if the increasing rate of autism claimed in the early study showed that mercury had no role in causing autism, then logic would also require that the rate of autism going down, as shown in the current study, indicates that mercury and vaccines may very well have a great deal to do with causing autism. There's a huge discrepancy between the total number of children with autism diagnosed in Denmark during the study period between the two papers. Now, both papers were drafted in part by research from the University of Aarhus in Denmark, with support from the U.S. CDC. Both papers claim to have drawn their data from the National Registry of Health Information that includes all children born in Denmark and another registry that records all psychiatric disorders among Danish children. Both studies looked at the same time period, 1995 to 2000, yet the two studies looking at supposedly the exact same data during the exact same period of time have two completely different conclusions about the growth of autism in Denmark. The 2003 study, Thimerosal and the Occurrence of Autism, Negative Ecological Evidence from Danish Population Database, was performed under the direction of the fugitive, Dr. Paul Thorsen, who was hired by the CDC to do a series of epidemiological studies in Denmark. Now, Thorsen's concluded there was no causal connection with autism, and that was what was used to this day. However, the exact number of cases of autism in the Danish children is difficult to ascertain. Why? because the actual numbers were never provided. Now, as you might expect in a study performed by competent professionals, but a crude graph shows a rise in autism from 1995 through 1999, but even in 2003, Thorson's graph showed a decline. And numbers before 1995 are not reliable because only children diagnosed with hospitalized and hospitalized for autism are included. Now, the new study, Recurrence of Autism Spectrum Disorder in Full, it shows that it increased, and I have the graph here in front of me showing every year, 1994 to 5, clear up to 2004, there was an increase every single year. Well, obviously, the rate of autism was increasing in one study and decreasing in the other, but then here's the pickle in all this. In the Thorson study, in his paper, he claims that there were only 956 children diagnosed with autism in Denmark between 1971 and 2000. Yet, the new study claims that from 1980 to 1999, there were 12,698 cases of autism spectrum disorders. Well, that's a 1,300% discrepancy. How in the world could you have a 1,300% discrepancy and someone not challenge this as a completely fraudulent study? Well, then we find out that there was a particular person, a Dr. Brian Hooker, who submitted several Freedom of Information Act requests to the CDC to obtain the data on this correspondence. And what he found was that, I will not mention the person's name, but there was a very influential person at the CDC who intervened and got some journals to, who had said no to the original article, to publish it. So from top to bottom, we can now say that Thorson's study was a fraud, that the people who engaged in it should be held as criminals and brought up on criminal charges, and that we now have absolute evidence, scientific evidence, from the CDC in a study that has received zero publicity, that when they stopped mercury in vaccines, autism levels were going down, not up. And so that's the latest on that. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Gary Knoll, nice to have you with us today. Let me say that starting this coming Monday at noon on all of our sister stations and Progressive Radio Network, and then Monday evening on Progressive Commentary Hour at 7, and then every single day next week, you will be hearing one full hour of original, in-depth investigative reporting on who actually conspired to kill JFK. This is going to be one of the most riveting, insightful discussions you have ever heard. These are not the wide-eyed, you know, conspiratorial theorists out there. These are legitimate researchers who've spent decades putting the pieces together. We have verified all the information, and we have selected the most significant, those whose evidence is compelling and who were first-person witnesses, including to the people engaged and who knew these people. You're going to find out who the real shooters were. There were three. You're going to find out who planned it. How could they get away with it, knowing that it would be investigated by the Secret Service, by the FBI, CIA? Who put together the names that people would appear on the Warren Commission? Who had the means to cover it up? How did they do it? Who is complicit in the media? Now, I've been listening to these programs talking about the anniversary. Oh, where were you at? You know, do you remember the day? And even the most tepid interview I could imagine from Oliver Stone talking about it, meaningless, nothing was learned. No, I can assure you, every single sentence, every single moment of 6 hours of original broadcasting, you're going to learn a history lesson you have not heard, read anywhere before. That begins and will go every day. Now, I realize that for some of our sister stations, they will be preempting programming, all programming, to raise money for their archives. We will still be broadcasting live every day. So if you can't hear it on your normal station, you can call up the phone number at 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869, and listen, or go to progressiveradionetwork.com and listen in. This is going to be one of the most powerful original investigative reporting series. We've been working on this for 11 months. So we've got the most interesting people, people you didn't even know existed. We have someone who, I will say no more, I don't want to give anything away, but every single piece of the puzzle we put together, all of it, each hour will be the complete hour just on this topic. I believe at 50-year anniversary, the people deserve the truth, and they're not getting it anywhere, including the alternative media. You know, I really don't care where someone was at, or I care about who did it, how they get away with it, who was behind it. That I care about. So that's what you're going to hear next week, starting Monday. In a few moments, we're going to go over and say hello to my guest, Robert Wiedemeyer. He is a respected financial analyst and investment consultant and president and CEO of Aftershock Publishing. And he was the one, by the way, who predicted the bubbles before they happen. And I'm interested in asking him to look at the risks of investing in the stock market and predictions of where it's heading. Because right now, if you listen to all the people on Wall Street, the talking heads, they're all telling you about how everything is great. You know, that we're in recovery mode, that corporate profits couldn't be better, and the bond market is terrific. And they're not talking about the fact that our entire economy today is based upon a bubble. And that all these bubbles, corporate real estate bubble, the bond bubble, they're not talking about any of this. What happens if this implodes? So we're going to ask him about that. You won't miss that. That'll be in a few minutes. Also, this coming Sunday, my two lectures, by the way, on Friday and Saturday are full. Sorry, no more room there. But on Sunday, I'll be premiering my new film and the only New York premiere for The Silent Epidemic. You won't want to miss that at noon, with a lecture following it, at the Huntington Cinema Arts. You can, the number to call for reservations is 631-423-7619, 631-423-7619. And I've done 6 premieres out there in the last 3 years. They've all been full. I'm assuming this will be full as well. This is from Ralph Nader from Counterpunch. It'll be posted today along with about 70 other articles on our website. This is called The Corporate State of Surveillance. America was founded on the ideals of personal liberty, freedom, and democracy. Unfortunately, mass spying, surveillance, and the unending collection of personal data threatened to undermine civil liberties and our privacy rights. What started as a necessary means of reconnaissance and intelligence gathering during World War II has escalated into an out-of-control snoop state where entities, both governmental and commercial, are desperate for as much data as they can grab. We find ourselves in the midst of an all-out invasion on what's none of their business, and it's coming from both government and corporate sources. Snooping and data collection have become big business. Nothing is out of their bounds anymore. The Patriot Act enabled National Security Agency certainly blazed one trail. The disclosures provided by Edward Snowden has brought into light the worst fears that critics of the overwrought Patriot Act expressed back in 2001. The national security state has given a blank check to the paranoid intelligence community to gather data on nearly everyone, Internet and telephone communications of millions of American citizens and millions more citizens and leaders of other countries, even friendly ones like France, Germany, and Brazil, have been on surveillance targets. Over 30 foreign leaders are now reported to have been targeted by this dragnet-style data collection. More blatantly, covert devices were reportedly placed in European Union offices and earlier by Hillary Clinton and her State Department on the United Nations to eavesdrop on every diplomat and world leader. Many Americans are not pleased either. And while most of the recent public outrage in the United States has been directed at instances of government snooping, giant private corporations are equally as guilty as the troubling invasion of people's selves. Companies such as Google, Apple, Microsoft, and Facebook blatantly collect and commercialize personal data, often covering their tracks with complicated fine print user agreement contracts that most people whose property it is, quote, agree to without any consideration, clicking I agree on an expansive, non-negotiable user agreement for website or software program is, to most people, just another mindless click on the mouse in the sign-up process. These take-it-or-leave-it contracts leave the consumer with little power to protect their own interest. And that's unfortunate. Just last week, news broke that Google plans to roll out a new advertising feature called Shared Endorsements. This policy allows Google the right to create user endorsements online advertisements. So if a Googler happens to share their preference for a particular product online, his or her endorsement might end up featured in an ad without any notice or compensation. Of course, users are welcome to opt out of this program, but how many millions will remain ignorant of the fact that they are unwillingly co-opted in by clicking their consent to contract terms they did not bother to read out of habit? Opting out should be the default option for all these types of agreements. School children are also being targeted by mass data collections. InBloom, a nonprofit organization based in Atlanta, offers a database solution for student records between grades K-12. And in theory, this service is supposed to make it easier for teachers to utilize emerging educational products and tools. But in practice, many parents are concerned about how this data will be used. In one instance, for example, student social security numbers were uploaded to the service. One parent told the New York Times, quote, "It's a new experiment in centralizing massive metadata on children to share with vendors, and then the vendors will profit by marketing their learning products, their apps, and their curriculum materials, their video games back to our kids." Facebook poses another data mining risk for young children. Although Facebook does not currently allow children younger than 13 to join, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act prevents the online collection of data of children without parental permission. Reportedly, more than 5 million underage children use the social media website anyway. This exposes them and their personal information to thousands of advertisers that use Facebook to collect marketing data and promote their products. The Washington Post recently reported that one international company behind snack brands like Chips Ahoy and Ritz has plans to deploy electronic camera sensors in snack food shelves to collect shopper data. These smart shelves can scan and save a customer's facial structure, age, weight, and even detect if they pick something off the shelf. The device can then use that gathered data to target the consumers with personalized ads. So, he's concerned. He says, this Saturday, a coalition of groups, including the ACLU, Public Citizen, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the Libertarian Party, and many more, are gathered at the National Mall to protest mass surveillance by the National Security Agency. That's a first good step. I would agree with that. We just have to stop allowing ourselves to be a part of a corporate spy state. And even if you protest anything today in the United States, any and every protester is targeted by one of the government agencies, because today you consider it your First Amendment rights to write or speak out on issues that you find important to you. The government considers that a threat because it threatens the corporate interest. If you're against global warming and you want to challenge the Koch brothers and their industries, now you're considered a threat. If you want to clean up our terrible seed distribution system from Monsanto, you'll be considered a government threat. That shouldn't be that way, and that is that way. Let's go over and say hello to my guest who's standing by, Robert Wiedemer. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Gary.
First of all, congratulations on Aftershock and Aftershock Investor. You were the one who called it right. You even were more detailed and accurate than Rabini and some of the others. I had Gerald Celante 1 year before the breakdown of Wall Street, and we were talking about the fact we had five bubbles: the commercial housing bubble, the real estate bubble, the commercial real estate bubble, the hedge fund bubble, the credit card bubble, and the equity partnership bubble. Everybody was dealing in debt and considering their debt an asset. And for the average person, that would be a big mistake. You called it. You were accurate then. What do you see now? Where do you see the new bubbles occurring? What is your belief on Wall Street and the enormous bubble that it has there and its ability to use its assets to further empower itself, where the average person is stuck in a spiraling, almost death spiral of debt?
Well, I see the bubbles today the ones that are being created today are just what we talked about actually in our very first book, America's Bubble Economy, which we wrote in 2005 and was published in 2006, well before the financial crisis, where we said that there would be, and kind of like what Celente said, but we combined all those bubbles heavily into the private debt bubble, the housing bubble, consumer spending bubble, and the stock bubble. And we said all four of those bubbles would go up until one burst, bringing down, which would be the housing bubble, and bring down the others. And then we would try to pump up those bubbles, all four of those bubbles, with two other bubbles, the government debt and the dollar bubble, or a dollar bubble is actually the money printing bubble. So, and that's what's happened. And that has worked in a sense. We, by massively increasing the amount of money we print, we're printing $85 billion a month, which, to put that in perspective, you know, it's about $1 trillion a year, and that's about as much money as the Federal Reserve printed in almost the first 100 years it was around. Between 1913 and 2007, before the crisis, we actually hadn't even printed $1 trillion. Now we're doing that every year. We're borrowing $700 billion, and to put that in perspective, the government is, our GDP is only going to grow about $300 billion. So we're actually borrowing, as a government, twice as much as our economy is even growing. So sometimes they say this whole recovery is fake. It's 100% fake. And, you know, alluding to what you said earlier in the program, that's sort of what's driving Wall Street, is this massive money printing, this massive stimulus-induced recovery, which is really a fake recovery because it's stimulus, you know, it's basically based on that stimulus. And so that's driving the markets. Just as we said back in 2005, that, the reaction would be to print and borrow more. That's exactly what we're doing, and it is working. And we said it would work to some degree. But it's just creating a much bigger bubble that will ultimately pop. And I don't think ultimately means our grandchildren or anything like that. I think we'll pop in the next few years. And then that bring down all the other bubbles. So that's the problem we have with Wall Street. Not that the market couldn't go up further. I think very likely we'll certainly see a Dow over 16,000. But it ultimately is based on a bubble that isn't going to work. The market's going up 20%, earnings are going up 2%. You know, economy's only been growing about 2%. This isn't a fundamental way to have a market going up 20%, and ultimately it will pop. Doesn't necessarily mean it will pop tomorrow. In fact, I'm sure it won't. I think we've got market could go up a bit more, but then I think it'll take a longer term decline, and then it ultimately will pop with bad consequences for all the bubbles.
I'd like for you to break this into its pieces. That's how I analyze every problem.
Mm-hmm.
I start off by asking, we're told that we're a healthy, vibrant economy. For 250 million Americans, they're living near, at, or below the poverty level. They have an average of over $36,000 in debt. There's $1 trillion debt in student loans alone, about $900 billion in credit cards. But if you took our personal debt, our mortgages debt, you took our corporate debt, our state debts, federal debts, unfunded entitlements, funded entitlements, and shortfalls, it's over $200 trillion. I'd like to know how anyone could, and with a reasonable approach to life, could say that we're healthy and have a good future when 75% of the American population are struggling and will continue to struggle, and then that's part of it. The second part of it is, to the very people who are struggling the most, you then start to go through austerity programs, much as they've done in Greece or France, in Ireland. And so you start cutting away at their social safety nets. And at the same time, you allow major corporations who are sitting on a tremendous amount of capital, of profits, anywhere between $2 to $3 trillion, plus 33 trillion offshore. You allow them to keep fewer people working, offshoring more jobs, and yet you say somehow we're supposed to be thriving. And I'm asking, how can you thrive when people are not getting a living wage? How can you thrive when people don't have the jobs they should have, are educated to have, and are dropping out of the workforce? So you're not even accounting the people who have stopped looking. You're not accounting the people because of age discrimination can't get a job, and those who are highly educated can't get a job in the field and be paid something commensurate to their education. And so those two formulas don't mix, in my opinion. I'd like your thoughts.
Well, you're very much correct and on track in many respects. The reality just of the recent jobs report says a lot right there. We had a growth of 200,000 jobs, but we had almost 750,000 people leaving the workforce. If you actually tacked in even the government's own figures of, you know, underemployed, partially employed, along with the unemployed, which is about 14-15%, you tacked onto that the people who have dropped out of the workforce at another 4% for that, you're getting near depression levels of unemployment, almost 20%. Just reading a comment here by University of California, Berkeley economist, saying that since 1983, this goes back quite a ways, Gary, since 1983, the bottom 90%, I didn't say 9, but 90% of American families, their average income fell 1.2% since 1983. So what you're seeing is real incomes aren't going up, and that's exactly why you're seeing so much debt being taken on. It's as if you had lost your job, but said everything's fine because I just got 10 new credit cards, with $20,000 limit on each of them. So, you know, I'm spending, everything's fine. But fundamentally, the incomes aren't going up. Fundamentally, we're taking on a massive amount of debt. And that's, you know, that's what's happening. The job and jobs aren't there. We literally are near, you know, depression levels types of unemployment. For new, especially new students entering the job market, they can see it. It's tough. We're not having the layoffs we used to, great, which is very good, but overall it's masking something that isn't just brand new. As I mentioned, this, you know, figure for the bottom 90% of American families, showing average income only going up 1.2%, you know, adjusted for inflation, you know, it tells you a lot. And that's the fundamental issue is, you're right, we're not doing too well. I might add the top 1%, incomes for the top 1% have gone up 145% adjusted for inflation, according to the same economist from University of California. So it's a huge problem, and that's kind of fundamental to why our economy is growing very slowly.
Robert, my last question, and I'd like a short answer if you could, please.
Sure.
We're up against the clock here. Some of us, myself included, believe that the United States, sooner rather than later, would lose the position of having the world's reserve currency in the dollar, and that will adversely affect the wealth of those dollars and the cost of those dollars. There'll probably be some form of mixed currencies with yuan and others dominating. We don't know when that'll occur, but we believe it will occur. And in the United States, no one in the official media or the government is talking at all about the loss of the dollar as a reserve currency and the consequences that could happen from that. Would you discuss your thoughts on that, please?
Yes, and what we're losing, reserve currency is a technical term I'll mention in a second, but fundamentally you're correct, is that the U.S. is losing its respect as in terms of its financial system, its dollar. I mean, we built up, frankly, a pretty good system for over, you know, a couple hundred years. We were one of the most careful and best managed financial systems in the world. I mean, most countries have had huge problems, you know, in the last 100 years. Germany, France, I mean, major countries, Britain, Japan. We've actually done very well. But now with that borrowing and printing, you're undermining the good faith in the dollar. And that's going to be a huge issue. It might remain a technically reserve currency, meaning it's held by some central banks as part of, you know, because we're a large trading economy. But what you are losing is that respect that's so critical to getting people to buy our bonds, buy our stocks, and invest in our economy. And those foreign investments in our economy have been massively important over the last 20, 30 years in helping to boost, well, our economy and the bubbles. We are losing that. It may not be obvious now. I think it's obvious to many people, but you're right. Certainly the government's not talking about it because it hasn't quite hit yet. but it will, and it's obvious what we're doing to cause that problem.
Robert, thank you for your insights. We appreciate it, and all the best with Aftershock Investor and Aftershock. The website is aftershockpublishing.com. My guest, Robert Wiedemeier, Wiedemeier. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you for listening.